Thank you, John. Well, first of all, I'd like to say what an honour and a privilege it is to be here, and I'd like to thank the organising committee for inviting me to such a wonderful conference. I've travelled here with my wife, and she'd also like to thank the committee because she's found a wonderful shopping experience here in Atlanta. I haven't quite worked out what the damage to the credit card is yet, though. Do I switch this on? Sorry, just... yep. Well, thanks for that introduction. It's all there, actually, on that slide, anyway. What I'd like to cover... I've actually put indicating about communities of practice, which are still only gradually being accepted as a valid way of learning and sharing. And one of the things, what I wanted to cover was this: how, in actual fact, we actually assess the value from the shared knowledge that communities of practice can deliver. I.e., what is the return on investment for a collaborative network? And what have we learned from the communities of practice in UK local government? I was trying to find a story that would connect public health and value, and I came up with this. I'm not sure if anybody's clever enough to know what this is. It's nutmeg. Now, how could I connect public health with value using nutmeg? Well, I will tell you at the end. I thought perhaps a little bit about UK local government. Employs 2.1 million people. There's over 700 services delivered to residents. And there's a budget of around about $177 billion. So it's quite a big enterprise. Lots of different services. People sort of associate things like bin collection and car parking and so on, but in actual fact, the services covering social care, welfare, care of the elderly, child protection, many, many different services across the local government sector. And one of the key things that of importance to the sector is how efficiently these services are being delivered. Citizens have to pay taxes, and they want to know that their money is being spent effectively. The Improvement and Development Agency, who I was contracted to work for in terms of developing a knowledge management strategy in 2005, there's an organization that is devoted to helping local councils improve their services, provide a number of different support services to councils in terms of leadership training. It's accountable through a stakeholder board, and it's actually funded by the councils themselves. It's there as a sort of knowledge management factory. It's actually there to support and help people deliver better services. The Communities Practice Platform, this was part of the strategy I promoted for the IDA. It seemed obvious to me at the time that, and perhaps people can relate to this sort of thing, we've got 411 councils, and that meant 411 different ways of doing things, 411 different wheels being invented. When policy was developed from government, there would be 411 different ways of actually delivering that policy to citizens. So I suggested, wouldn't it be good if we actually provided an environment where these people could connect and learn and share knowledge, and rather than creating 411 different ways of doing it, we haven't got to the utopian way of actually doing it once, but we've certainly helped in terms of actually reducing the number of duplicate ways of doing things and standardizing some of the practices. And this actually got created on a community practice platform, which has now got 35,000 users on it. We have 90 new people registering each day. We have 10 new communities started each day. Slightly different to the way I think you're developing your platform here at the moment is that anybody within the local government sector can create their own space on this platform. if they've actually got a particular issue, the particular project that they actually want to collaborate on, they can actually create a space and draw people in to actually start connecting and collaborating. That's what it looks like. I can't linger on. That's the front page. We've actually got a number of tools on there, wikis, blogs, forums, or fora. Anybody on the platform can have their own blog to actually promote what they're doing, wikis for collaborating and sharing on documents. So a standard set of tools. I thought it worthwhile showing this because there's still this perhaps misconception about what a community of practice is, and I particularly wanted to point out where you've actually got a project team, which most people are familiar with, and the members are usually assigned by senior management to that particular team. Key thing about a community of practice is that the members select themselves. They're there because they want to be there. They are motivated to actually be part of that community. And one of the problems certainly I had in with managers in the Improvement and Development Agency when we started this off was trying to convince them that they couldn't tell their people, their staff, to go and join a community. It had to be something that was voluntarily that they did. Or if in actual fact they did force people to join a community, there was no way of forcing them to collaborate. Maybe this seems obvious, but it wasn't obvious to some of the managers there. So what's new about communities of practice? Well, I dug around in the archives and found a number of examples of communities of practice that existed way back in the 14th, 15th, 16th century. The Painters Guild, the Guild of Goldsmiths, the Worshipful Company of Glaziers, the Worshipful Company of Fletchers, people in actual fact who are a professional organization for making arrows. Which in actual fact is still alive and functional today. Also, look, there was a directory of worshipful companies. Now, I don't know if there's anything similar to that in the States. And I created a little Wordle picture just to show how many there were. I don't know if you can actually see the smaller words on there. You know, there's plumbers, there's clockmakers, goldsmiths, silversmiths. Over 800 companies that are still working as communities of practice. Maybe they don't call themselves communities of practice, but they're there because they want to share knowledge, best practice within their profession. So, there's nothing new about people gathering and sharing knowledge, nothing new about communities. But the question that occurs to me is, have we forgotten how to have conversations? And I say that because of the experience that we've seen in gathering these people together to collaborate and communicate in local government. And I looked at, well, you know, what the 20th century has given us. Well, it's given us mass production. And mass production means that you've actually given a particular task and you actually complete that task before you hand over to the next person in line. There's no requirement for actually thinking beyond what your particular task is on that production line. 20th century has given us uniformity and repetition. Perhaps people as commodities. And the realization now that jobs change fast. People in actual fact need to adapt and actually gather new skills all the time. And this, I think, in actual fact, is a key difference between where we were on the 20th century and where we're now going on the 21st century, is this importance for people to develop and actually be able to adapt and actually learn new skills. And I wonder, you know, is this what we ask for or what managers think we need? And this is not any particular dig for anybody here. I mean, that exactly the way that we work, they still work in the Improvement and Development Agency. Everybody has their cubicle cut off from their colleagues. And I think Einstein got it right. You know, if you always do what you always did, you're always going to get the same result. But do we want the same result? Same result doesn't mean improvement, doesn't mean innovation. If we want to innovate, we have to somehow change. Well, a number of, I say this is not profound. We don't know what we don't know. People don't necessarily learn from content, they learn from other people. We don't know what the value of knowledge is until we've shared it with somebody. And we need to find where the conversations are happening and join in. And that's, I think, the most exciting aspect of where we are now, and as we move further into the 21st century, there are now so many opportunities to connect, to collaborate. So many different social networks out there. Many, many different opportunities to join and connect. Now, I want to tell a brief story about, and this is true, there was, in 2005, there was a surgeon in Cardiff, and Cardiff is a city in Wales, in the UK, and this surgeon was dealing primarily with knife crime. And over a period of time, through the patients he was dealing with, he started to build up a picture of where a lot of the knife crime was happening in Cardiff, i.e. the areas, the times of day. And he decided to go and communicate this information to the police, maintaining patient confidentiality, of course, but he informed them based on this picture that he had actually sort of been creating through his dialogue with his patients. And the police, through this information, were able to better target their resources to the areas that were causing the problems. And over 1 year, knife crime in Cardiff got reduced by 60%. Now, the surgeon in question actually did communicate this through his own network, through his publications in the medical journals. Now, we're in 2009, 4 years later. How many councils do you think have picked up on what he did and actually have actually transposed that knowledge, that learning, into what they're doing? Well, out of 411 councils, 20 have. And why haven't the others? Because they don't know about it. And I think this is the whole issue about how, in actual fact, we connect and we collaborate. It's not going to be done for us, but there are networks out there that we need to tap into. It's not necessarily going to be obvious to a council employee to start reading medical journals, but there are ways, in actual fact, of actually taking feeds from medical systems, medical journals, such that they can actually gather this information in one place. And I think this is what, I know you can't actually see the detail of this diagram, but this whole aspect of actually bringing together information from lots of different sources. I've heard a number of, while I've been here, speakers talking about siloed working and siloed data. I actually don't think we're ever going to get out of this concept of siloed data. I gave up on it a long time ago, thinking that we're going to have one aggregated database. But there are tools and technologies out there now that help us to actually bring together these siloed bits of information, this siloed data, and to actually aggregate it and to make sense of it, to filter it and to use it. And this is what we should be doing. I thought I'd mention about, you know, what collaboration actually means, like what it's not and what it is. One of the issues, I'll go back to this last week, you know, we've forgotten to have conversations. I think that we are, many of us conditioned for the way that we, some of us actually have worked in the 20th century, to have difficulty in this aspect of collaborating. It's a skill or a set of practices that's not necessarily taught. We either know how to do it or we don't, and perhaps there is an issue there that we actually need to devote more time, effort, and attention into training or support or coaching or mentoring to help people to collaborate. And I come back to this ROI, this return on investment. I mean, we're 2 years into this program now of getting people to collaborate, and maybe that's perhaps too early for you. I'm sort of predicting where you're going to go, because there is an investment in time, effort, money in actually building these collaborative networks. Somebody at some point is going to ask, well, what value are we getting from this? What return on this investment are we getting? I tend to sort of use this mantra, keep the I small and the R will look after itself. Keep the investment small. Now, it's a good point, this, because a lot of collaborative networks, I'm thinking in terms of the technology, is very, very cheap. Cheap to the point, and quite often it's free. If you are in fact investing in a collaborative environment, it doesn't have to cost a lot. But the more it costs, the more you're going to be questioned in terms of what return is. And I thought as well, you know, we talk about return on investment, perhaps in actual fact we should talk about return on influence or interaction or impact. Those are possibly more important than this concept of return on investment. But there's different perceptions. If you're a community member, the value to you is actually how much you put into that community, how much in actual fact you actually invest your time in sharing what you know or learning from what other people know from that community. And there's benefits to the organization and benefits to the individual, and they are different, and they're probably going to be measured in a different way. Now, I think in terms of my environment, where efficiency is the main thing that people are looking for, in our platform, we've had 8 online conferences. Okay, so this is a way by which people from across the UK sector can join in a conference in a virtual sense. Just as an example there, so 100 people attending an event in London would cost, with the rooms and lunch, $8,200, and then there's the travel. So you're looking at a cost for a conference of about $13,000 for 100 people. Now, that's the sort of information that would interest the people in local government in terms of cost and efficiency. So the fact that we can actually deliver this same sort of thing in an online way is obviously very attractive to them, and they see the value in that. But measuring the value to an individual is far more difficult. The only way that we know how to do this, we ask the members themselves what value they've got out of their community, and we actually have an annual survey. And these, I won't read these out. These are some of the quotes that we've actually received from various people using the community, so keeping up to date with current thinking. Excuse me for going through these fairly quickly, but I think these slides are going to be made available online. Innovations and sharing good practice. Building relationships, having an ongoing network of contacts online. Or there's another way of measuring value, and this is actually through productivity. The diagram on the left there actually shows possibly the traditional way how we collaborate with a Word document as an attachment to emails, gets circulated to different people. People, I'm sure, relate to this concept. You know, somebody updates it, gets passed on to somebody else. Compared with the wiki concept, where in actual fact you've actually got a copy which is available to everybody, and everybody can actually access and update that one copy and see what changes have been made by other people. A huge change or improvement in productivity. So metrics and measurement are important. And I've actually listed some things there that we do and possibly that you'll follow as well about the things that you'll do. You'll first of all identify business objectives, priorities, choose what to measure. And you're going to measure things that are both qualitative and quantitative. It's a good idea to benchmark yourself if you can with other people. And it doesn't have to be the same industry. We're benchmarking ourselves across a number of private sector organizations. And then identify trends and reporting. Those are our business objectives, and you can see that they're all around, well, the key one there, connecting people, efficiency and value for money, and sustainable self-improvement. Those are the driving principles for the community of practice in local government. What to measure? Well, to be honest, we're trying to measure everything. Because I'm sure that somebody's going to tell me one day, well, have you actually got this figure? And I'm going to be able to say yes. Number of contributing members, quite useful. Percentage of members who are contributors. Now, interesting on this one, and I'll mention this because one of the factors that seems to worry a lot of managers is how many people are actively contributing to a community. You can see on there we've got around about 15%, which is pretty good actually. I know of one particular manager who has insisted that he wants a 40% contribution rate. That is just, when we do our benchmarking, anybody, in fact, I don't think we've come across anybody with a contribution rate that high. So setting realistic targets is another key issue. And what we're going to do with this information, all this data that we're collecting, we're measuring, we're looking at? Well, what we should be doing with it is understanding our community. We should understand what our breakdown is between the people who are reading. I've called them observers there. A lot of people call them lurkers. I don't particularly like that term. People who, in actual fact, are not contributing, but potentially learning from what they're seeing. The inactive people, people who have registered on the platform but have done nothing at all. The contributors, okay, so these people in actual fact are adding comments and so on. And then you're going to end up with a fairly small proportion of power contributors. And these are the people that are updating more than once a day and usually adding or contributing some unique and different aspect as opposed to just comments on other people's posts. It's also good to get an insight of how your information is flowing. And you can actually build this up through something called a social network analysis graph. You can see where information is flowing, where the nodes are for those people, in actual fact, who are a key part of that network. You can also see the outliers from this, i.e. the people, in actual fact, are perhaps not part of the central network. But it gives you an opportunity to intervene, to actually take some action if you want to start integrating some of those people more closely into the where the conversations are happening. So a social network analysis is quite a good way of actually identifying where to intervene to actually improve your knowledge flows. But, I think these are important, don't rely on metrics to claim your community is successful. You should be using it to better understand your community. And the third bullet point, really important, don't let managers turn indicators into targets. If you've got an indicator which indicates you've got a 10% contribution rate, don't let that be now a target. Remember that the community is there because people want to be there. They shouldn't be there because they're being driven by some target. And the chicken doesn't get fatter the more you weigh it. You can keep weighing it. It's not going to make any difference at all to actually how effective your community is. So I come back to what we've learned. Now, I'm sure that you want to go and make your own mistakes. We all do. And I wonder if in 12 months' time you'll come back and look at some of the mistakes that we've made and say, oh, yes, well, we made that one as well. But first of all, tools that can support collaborative working. Now, the most important tool I've found is the top two. Find and connect with experts and find and connect with your peers. Having a directory of who's there and what their expertise is, what their interests are, that is hugely, hugely important and probably the most effective part of the community practice that we built in local government. People can join that and they can actually do a search on expertise or a search on a particular keyword and actually identify people that they might want to connect with. Other things like wikis and forums and blogs, all helpful. And one of the things that we've learned, I think I've got it in a separate point actually, is don't force people to use these things. Let them decide for themselves what they're comfortable with using. And of course, it's more about the people than the technology. The technology is there to support, to help, but in actual fact, it's the people that really matter. Maybe ask me to sort of identify, you know, how much time it takes in a COP. And this is actually based on an analysis we did in a survey. It's from very little time in terms of just reading content through to if you are facilitating a COP, it takes lots of time, more than 10 hours a week. And the thing about facilitation is that the successful communities have always got a very active and successful facilitator. There's a direct correlation. If I looked at our 820 communities, I would never tell you that we've got 820 successful communities. I would say we've probably got about 300 or 400. And if I looked across those 300 or 400, I could guarantee they've all got a very good facilitator. So look after your facilitators. They're quite often the difference between success and failure. Let users decide for themselves and experiment on the tools that you give them. I won't read them all out. You can read these. These are carefully constructed, and I say based on some pain before we actually got there. At the last one, use online conferences and hot seats. I haven't talked about hot seats, but what we do is actually invite an expert in an online conference to actually sort of, he or she poses a question, and then we open it up to an online conversation, people posting questions in the forum. And those have been very, very successful, particularly if it's a renowned expert. We've even had a soap star come and talk. He'd written a book about fostering children. And we had him come along as a hot seat expert, and that obviously generated a lot of interest. The things don't think you can force people to collaborate. Maybe that's obvious, but not obvious to everybody. Don't assume everybody knows how to use these tools. We keep talking about Web 2 as if people knows actually how to start using these tools. Don't assume that. Don't assume everybody knows how to contribute. Don't worry about the lurkers. It goes back to this issue, you know, people are there because they want to be there. They don't have to contribute all the time. You don't really know what they're getting out of it, and they can leave whenever they want. So they individually must be getting something out of it by being there. Don't let command or control hamper the community, and don't set unrealistic targets. The other thing is know when to let go. Know when you don't need to sort of define how that community is going to work, or define what space they're going to use, or define when they can set up a space. Learn to trust. If it goes wrong, if the community doesn't work, I don't really know what you've lost. Okay, perhaps people have lost some time and effort, but nothing more than that. I believe in letting a thousand flowers bloom. Now, I picked this up from the benchmark report. People like sort of menus of things. These are 9 key factors that came out of a benchmark we did with Warwick University. Defining the focus of the community, ensure community activities address business issues. Yeah, there's something, some of these are obvious. Provide support, go back to the, you know, make sure that you're training your facilitators. Don't assume that facilitation is a natural ability. And finally, this is one of those quotes that I found on the internet, which I love. This actually says it all for me. This is about the people themselves feeling achievement in what they've delivered. Because I think this is true of communities of practice. A successful community of practice, you get the sense of a fulfillment that you've delivered something, you've achieved something, and you've done it together. You've done it collaboratively. So I come back to my nutmeg. And this connection between health and value. I'm not sure if you know this, but in the 17th century England, Elizabethan times, nutmeg was more precious, weight for weight, than gold. And the reason for that was because they believed that it was a cure for the plague. So value is created very much in what we believe in. And I'm not trying to say here, you know, as we now, we can laugh at this later on and thinking, oh, well, that was silly, but it was actually based on their understanding, their beliefs. And I think value is a very nebulous item. It means different things to different people. But I think if you believe in something strongly enough, you create the value from that belief. I'd like to thank you for your attention, and I look forward to any questions later on.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just over here.